You see, I am cutted this for you. The pinky nail he'd grown to use as an ever-ready Coke spoon was cut to the quick. You've stopped? Ruby asked. Completely?
See.
It was the final piece of evidence she needed. Javier had changed. On their second, ultimate night in California, Ruby asked him about his father.
Already, I have told you about him,
Javier said, gently brushing flakes of spent finger paint from her cheek. But who is he? Does he sing in the shower and cook like you do? Is he a good dancer? What does he like to read?
He took care of us when my mother died. She had the stomach cancer, he said, his palm flat against Ruby's belly.
How old were you when your mother died?
8 years old.
He pressed his thumb into her belly button. So young. She still couldn't bring herself to tell him of her 8-year-old self, wrapped in a blanket in the back seat of her parents' car. And he didn't ask. Finally, Javier looked from her body to Ruby's eyes.
Without her, he was sad and angry.
Did he hurt you?
See.
She wasn't sure she should press him, but maybe this was part of the answer she'd been seeking, the genesis of Javier's spontaneous combustion furor.
Did he hit you? See. He was always sorry, always sad after.
But he lost control. Javier nodded.
Then he would buy us a treat. I don't know what you call it. Ice ground very small with lemon or cherry syrup. Sometimes mango.
She felt compassion overtake her. It all made such abundant sense. Their cells must sing choruses of understanding to each other. Two ravaged children grown to adulthood.
I will be a good father to my children. I will love them as much as my father loves me, more. But I will never hurt them. Not like what I had, he vowed. You need to know that, my Ruby. I am done with that. Nunca más, mi amor.
Nunca más, Ruby repeated, feeling hope and faith twining, a sturdy vine that would let her scale the roughest wall. She'd climb to joy, to a future thick with promise. The next morning, Ruby stood in the hotel bathroom listening to the faucets drip. She was wavering. She wanted, for once in her life, to make a leap of faith. And so, after taking a deep breath, she used her fingernail scissors to cut an open heart into the center of her diaphragm.
Is true? Javier asked, grinning hugely. You will do it? Live with me? Have babies with me? Come to be here in this place?
He looked down at the ruined diaphragm cupped in his hands. And when he looked back up at her, she could see tears in his eyes.
You still love me? He asked needlessly.
She thought about saying, yes, but you'd better keep your promises. But she didn't. She didn't want to spoil the moment. She didn't want to spoil their future. No, she'd taken that leap. And now she intended to let go of the past, to see everything with eyes that dared to believe.
I didn't know how to tell you, and so I kept putting it off, Ruby said, seated in the shade of an umbrella by the apartment pool with Dee, Vivid, and Rose.
Rose's wedding was in 2 days, and they were having one last get-together before Rose moved into married life. The silence was decidedly uncomfortable. Vivid tapped a spoon on the tabletop, and Dee escaped to get more ice for the pitcher of margaritas. Rose was the only one who held her ground, refusing to look away from Ruby.
It's like you're an addict or something, Rose said. I mean, Jesus, Ruby, what does it take? Does he have to put you in the hospital? Rob you blind?
Vivid set down the spoon and picked up a fork.
So, let me get this straight, she said. Your plan is to quit your job, move to San Francisco, and live in some hovel with a complete and total asshole.
He's not, Ruby began, but Vivid spoke over her.
Don't forget I know, she said, her jaw clenched. That kind of bullshit behavior does not go away. Poof.
She raised a hand, looked up as if she could see a puff of smoke.
He's passionate. We both are. We're like Taylor and Burton, Ruby said, desperate to convince her audience.
Taylor and Burton? Dee was back with the ice. You're comparing yourself to Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton?
Oh, for fuck's sake, Vivid said. This is your logic? Really?
They have a tempestuous kind of love, Ruby said. They have their ups and downs, their dramas, their breakups, and their makeups.
So you think you and Javier are what? Antony and Cleopatra? Dee asked.
At least Liz Taylor gets $65,000 necklaces for her pains, Vivid said.
And she can just jet off to Monaco when she wants to escape, Dee poured herself another margarita.
I hear she gives as good as she gets, Rose said.
Ruby stood, angrily.
I knew you wouldn't understand, she said, but it doesn't matter. I'm going with him.
Then get ready, Vivid said, pinning Ruby with her gaze.
She pushed the prongs of the fork into the tender skin of her own forearm.
He'll start like this.
She pushed harder, deepened the indentations.
He'll push until he makes you bleed. And one day, she paused, he'll kill you.
Oh, no, Rose said, disbelieving.
Oh, come on, Vivid, Dee said.
I already tried breaking this particular horse the gentle way.
Vivid set the fork down and patted it as if to make it stay in place.
It didn't work, she said, looking meaningfully at Ruby. And so now I'm changing tack.
I'm sorry you don't understand, Ruby managed before turning away and walking back to her apartment.
She was breathing fast and could feel the adrenaline threading through her veins.
They didn't understand. She knew they wouldn't. Vivid was exaggerating what she'd seen with Javier. Pure drama. He'd barely hurt her. And Vivid hadn't seen Javier's behavior in San Francisco. He'd been a different person, away from the stresses of his life in Vegas. None of them had seen the promise in his eyes. How chagrined he was by his previous poor behavior. How much her yes had meant to him. They didn't understand devotion, what it was like to believe in another person. Vivid, in particular, with her admitted distrust, her purposefully shallow love affairs, she could never comprehend real love. They all behaved politely, if somewhat distantly, at Rose's wedding. And then, on the following Monday, Ruby found a telephone message waiting for her at the casino. It was from Sammy Davis Jr. Shaking with excitement, she called the number and his manager answered. At long last, the week-long trip to entertain the troops was set. They'd leave for Vietnam on July 29th, in just over 3 weeks. The manager had already spoken with Bob Christensen, who was willing to give Ruby time off in exchange for publicity photos the Dunes could use to take full advantage of Ruby's goodwill gesture. All 10 members of the troupe, Sammy and his wife, a 4-piece band, 3 backup singers, and Ruby, would participate in the photo shoot. Was she still willing? Yes!
She screamed into the phone, not caring one bit that she might sound like an overeager teenager.
God, yes! She added.
Davis had married for a third time, this time to Alto V. Score, who had worked as a dancer in London and on Broadway. With her permanently surprised eyebrows, her luscious lips and body, she was stunning. Alto V's choreographed the shows, and 2 brief rehearsals were held at the Sands, where Davis performed. A USO officer also met with the troupe, telling them what they could expect in Vietnam. He kept using the word primitive, and Ruby thought that of course war-torn Vietnam would be a rough trip. Sammy and Alto V would be paid $100 a day. Ruby and all the others would receive $25. The trifling pay hardly mattered. At last, Ruby was contributing. She would be part of something that actually mattered, and heading to Vietnam was head and shoulders above a group of prima donna college students marching in circles with placards. Two, she knew that this adventure would serve as her perfect last hurrah before she retired as a showgirl. In the past, she'd inadvertently triggered his rage. This time, she would control the situation. Ruby told Javier about Vietnam while they were standing in the checkout line at the grocery store, where he'd be less likely to cause a scene. She was right. Javier maintained his self-control. But only until they got to her Ghia and began fitting grocery bags beneath the hood. Ruby bumped into him as she jostled a bag on her hip. "Sorry," she said.
"Are you?"
"Don't start." She tried to sound firm, in control.
"You want that I be quiet? That I no embarrass you?"
Ruby wedged in the last bag, reached up, and got ready to slam the hood.
"Wait," he said, gripping her wrist. "Not yet."
Javier reached into one of the bags and pulled out the carton of eggs. "What?" Ruby began. He removed an egg, balanced it in his palm.
"You want go off and be with these other men? To shake your culo for them? These men in the jungle who have no seen a woman for too long. You want to do this to my heart?"
He slammed the egg onto the asphalt, and the yolk bled out.
"That's my heart!"
She almost laughed. "Throwing eggs? Really?" Ruby tried to grab the carton, but he thrust it behind his back where she couldn't reach it.
"You want to go with this black man, travel with him 10,000 miles, and his band, those other men?"
He began nodding, convincing himself of his veracity.
"That's it. You want to go fuck these other men. What is you always say? Oh, yes, you want fuck your brains out with black men with big dicks."
"Let's get in the car," Ruby said, aware that other shoppers were stopping to stare. "Javier, let's talk about this privately."
"Oh," he said with a mock grin, "now she wants private. This woman who shows the whole world her tits and her culo. She wants private," he sneered.
Ruby took out her car keys. She hated his childish high drama, but just now there was no point in trying to reason with him. She didn't see it coming. The egg hit her squarely on the head. She felt it dripping, viscous and slow down her forehead, and she used the back of her hand to try to keep it from running into her eyes. He came around to her side of the car and began pelting her in the back with one egg after another.
"Fuck you, Ruby!" he screamed. "Fuck you, you cunt!"
She turned and faced him. She would do this differently, refuse to yell back. She would stay calm, and that would bring him under control. He'd quickly see that he was behaving like a child throwing a tantrum. "Your English is getting much better," she said, rather pleased with her self-control. He'd run out of eggs, and that stalled him. Javier stood there, empty carton in hand. "Have you finished?" she asked, almost daring a smile. Over his shoulder, she saw a middle-aged man with black plastic-framed eyeglasses gesture to ask if she needed help, and she shook her head no. "Javier?" she asked. "Shall we get in the car and go home now?" It took a moment, and then he looked at the empty egg carton as if it were some foreign object he could not for the life of him identify. She saw a shift in his eyes. He'd released his anger, and he seemed deflated, pacified. Ruby searched her purse and found a packet of tissues. She pulled out several and cleaned off the egg as best she could. When Javier touched her arm, she flinched.
"Let me."
He took the tissues and cleaned the areas of her back she couldn't reach. Slowly, she thought with satisfaction. She was learning how to manage him. This would take time, practice. She sighed with relief. He wasn't stalking off, leaving her. He hadn't hurt her. This time, he was swiftly conciliatory. Once they were in the car, he rolled down his window, and Ruby started the engine.
"You knowed that saying?"
Javier asked.
"What?"
Ruby moved the gear shift into reverse.
"You can no make the omelet without first break the eggs."
"Ha!" Ruby let out a laugh. "Well, we're fresh out of eggs, mi amor."
"It's true,"
he said, placing his hand over hers on the gear shift.
"No more eggs. And I am sorry, my Ruby."
From then on, she included him in her preparations, thinking it would help him adjust. It seemed to work. He went with her while she chose a long wig in her hair shade, and he helped her find small gifts for the soldiers. Candy that wouldn't melt in the heat, Oreo cookies, cigarette lighters, paperback mysteries, and a stack of the August 1970 issue of Playboy, featuring a pictorial on Myra Breckinridge, which had just come out. Bob Christensen gave her a box containing 500 copies of her Dunes publicity photo so that she could autograph them and pass them out. She was to encourage the soldiers to come see her perform on a real stage once they got back to the States. Ruby hadn't yet told Bob of her retirement plans. That would all come later, when she had everything arranged. The night before she was to leave, Javier asked her to wear the new wig in bed, along with a red garter belt and thigh-high stockings he produced from the bottom drawer of the nightstand. And when she counted the Playboys before packing them in a duffel bag, there was one missing. She was glad of his small rebellion. 19.
1 week. That's all,
she said, standing with Javier on the Vegas airstrip, inhaling jet fuel and watching shimmering waves of heat hover above the pavement.
Then we start our new lives. I be here. Siempre,
he promised, folding her into his arms for one last strong embrace.
You don't worry, and come back safe.
They flew in an army transport plane with box lunches balanced in their laps, and they stopped in Hawaii, Guam, and then finally Vietnam. Ruby had a headache, likely brought on by the rumble of the engines and the noxious smell of jet fuel, and she felt slightly nauseated. The band members sat together. Sammy and Altavis were huddled up, and Ruby sat with the backup singers, Darlene, Misty, and Yvonne. The singers were all nervous, jittery, and extremely unsure of themselves. Dozing off and on to the drone of the plane's engines, she lost track of time, but well over 24 hours had passed by the time they at last landed at Thon Son Nhut, Saigon's airport. As Ruby descended the ramp, she was hit by a heavy, sweet smell that lodged in her nasal passages. She immediately recognized it as decay, death. She didn't really feel the heat until they were standing inside the claustrophobic makeshift customs building. But then she sensed how flushed she'd become. She felt dizzy, enervated. Uneasily, she answered a few questions posed by a surprisingly small, delicate Vietnamese officer. She swore she had no guns or knives, all the while thinking that everything, absolutely everything, seemed dirty, in need of paint and repair. Long trails of ants crawled up the wooden shack's dirty white pillars. Their first meal was fried chicken. Sammy joked that they must have heard that black people love fried chicken, and he wondered if they'd be served watermelon for dessert. Ruby picked at her meal, as did Darlene, a big-hipped girl with startled eyes and severely bitten nails. They performed their first show within 3 hours of landing. Sammy wore a silk, thigh-length Nehru jacket in a pink and orange paisley print. A huge gold medallion bumped against his chest as he sang, You've made me so very happy. He introduced Altavis, who sat with the bigwigs in the front row of the audience, and the crowd of thousands of soldiers cheered wildly when she stood. She thrust her fist in the air, and the Black Power salute was echoed by hundreds of black soldiers. Dressed in a white shell top that buttoned up the back, a single set of false eyelashes, a pair of sapphire blue hot pants, and her long wig flowing nearly to the middle of her back, Ruby whirled and kicked and swayed her hips to Lucretia MacEvil. She and Sammy played off of each other, and he invited soldiers to come on stage to take turns dancing with Ruby. Darlene, along with Misty and Yvonne, sang backup and snapped their fingers, wiping sweat from their foreheads with army-issue white handkerchiefs. Disoriented birds flew about the stage, and soldiers stood to take photos of Sammy in action. Movement revived Ruby, as did the contrast with her Vegas performances. The stage was small, not as small as many she'd perform on in the coming days, but it was not the grand expanse that she was used to. She loved the friendly informality, which let her interact with the band and Sammy, the other girls, and the audience in a more intimate way. She smiled at the sea of soldiers seated in waves of folding chairs, the men who hooted and whistled and called out for more, as well as the ones who made their way onto the stage to take her hand for a few moments, shyly to twirl her. She felt a shared history with these men, a childhood of the Lone Ranger, Superman, Malto Meal, and Campbell's Soup TV commercials. They'd all grown up singing the Libby's Jingle on playgrounds in Kansas, Wisconsin, along the eastern seaboard, and in the desolate, wintry plains of South Dakota. They shared the dashed hope of the Kennedys, the strict, disciplined parents whose worlds had been so severely shaped by the austerity of the Depression. They knew fractured innocence. As Ruby danced, the men answered with their enthusiasm. It was a fueled exchange, back and forth, back and forth. It was a conversation she never wanted to end. The men gave Sammy a fatigue jacket sewn with patches from different units. His Finch's body swam in the voluminous coat, which he wore proudly, with the sleeves rolled up. One of the men put a floppy boonie hat on Ruby and told her to keep it, said that he knew it would bring him good luck. He'd drawn on it in blue ballpoint ink, a peace symbol, a crude dove with an olive branch in its beak, and the name of his girlfriend, Chantel. In the audience, she saw a Vietnamese girl, maybe 8 or 9, incongruously seated in a row of men. One soldier held a frantic monkey on a leash in his lap. She saw crosses and dog tags. Some men were shirtless, wearing headbands to keep back long, decidedly unmilitary hair. And she saw bandages, wounded arms and legs, crutches, gauze covering a man's head as if he were a mummy. With his hip black mustache, dangling cigarette, and the worried-looking inverted V of his eyebrows, Sammy called upon his vaudevillian roots and charmed them all. He told jokes, he sang, he tap-danced speedy, intricate rhythms to standing ovations. He wore plaid bell-bottomed pants, never once tripped over the microphone cable, and never, ever complained about the abysmal sound systems. The slapdash stages, the dust, the dirt, the bugs, the food, or the fear. As if he were a tourist, he took hundreds of photos. He posed in hundreds more. Da Nang, Vung Tau, Freedom Hill, China Beach, Golden Gate, Liberty Center, Kung To Army Airfield, Long Binh and Cam Ranh Bay. In the streets of the bigger cities, a cacophony of horns sounded, motorcycles and scooters, bicycles and Citroens, and cars from a bygone era zoomed noisily past. Advertisements touted beer, cigarettes, Coca-Cola, and even photocopies.
The scent of exotic foods and spices mingled with the odor of shit. Some of the locations where they performed were relatively plush, with air conditioning and hot meals. In others, Ruby could see burned buildings and evidence of recent skirmishes with the Viet Cong. She saw beautiful, mist-topped mountains, rice paddies that stretched for miles, hills and rivers. She learned about elephant grass with razor-sharp edges that grew up to 15 feet high and was so thick it dropped men's visibility to less than a yard. She danced on hastily constructed wooden stages as small as 6 by 8 feet, beneath corrugated tin shelters, and to the twanging of pianos that couldn't hold a tune. Often emulating Anne Margaret, Ruby wore a turtleneck with nothing but black tights and high-heeled boots. And she gave all she had to young men who sat cross-legged in the dirt beneath a merciless sun. One afternoon, she splashed and laughed and swam with an infantry squad in a crater that had been made weeks earlier by a 2,000-pound bomb. She was surprised by the men's sweetness, their quiet respectfulness. They called her Miss and held doors for her. They eyed her with lust and longing, but not a one ever said anything stupid or insulting. These men didn't own her. They took her presence as a gift and a privilege, not a purchase made. She saw young men, not privileged, escapist college students, not fading middle-aged men. They were 18, 19, and 20. And she saw lean, muscled men with honest tans. She didn't see a single basketball-sized gut or ratty toupee. She saw men who'd come to realize what mattered in life, and it was not a gold pinky ring or a trip to the Bahamas. She glimpsed the ghosts of the French in the food she ate, the architecture, and faded signs. And she wondered why the United States was fighting for this country, a place so impoverished that people squatted by the side of the road to defecate, not caring who watched. Children, not even 7 years old, would run up to her and beg for cigarettes. Ruby felt guilty about everything she had back home. Her fur coats, her savings account balance, and her jewelry. Even her modest apartment with running water. People passed her, pulling overloaded carts as if they were beasts of burden. She saw malnourished children, children who were missing legs and who hobbled along meager dirt paths using homemade wooden staffs. They performed at camps and fire support bases, hospitals and rehab centers. Some of the audiences were 10,000 strong, others numbered under 50. Their helicopter would land, and Sammy would immediately jump out, start strumming his guitar and singing as he walked through the soldiers who came to greet and thank him. He took to wearing a canteen on his belt and was seemingly tireless. "They're lonesome," Sammy would say to Ruby. "Go mingle." And mingle she did. Those were the times that meant the most to her, when she could sit and actually converse with the soldiers. They drank lukewarm beer together, in air so thick with humidity that Ruby felt it could be stirred like a chowder. Some of them talked willingly, needfully about their lives. Others stared at nothing and moved in a world inaccessible to anyone but themselves. She memorized it all, collected stories to bring back to Javier. And then, at night, Ruby lay awake and listened to the distant boom of artillery.
"You want to know what it's like?"
a staff sergeant with the 9th Cavalry said, sitting on an overturned wooden crate, dirt lining the creases of his neck like the halting beginnings of a misbegotten tattoo.
"Then do this. When you get back to the world, load a pack with 85 pounds, strap it on, step into the shower with all your clothes on, stand there under the water for 3 days. Shut off the water every few minutes and stay there. Before your clothes can even think about drying out, turn that water back on. Keep standing there.
He was tall, lean, and he had sharp, unambiguous features that made her think of the aviator. His helmet said SGT Ben. "Your feet will rot," he continued. "You've got a good 45 mosquito bites on one arm alone. You've got the shits. You haven't bathed in months. You wash your clothes by walking through a muddy river." Ruby didn't know what to say, but soon enough she realized he didn't need or want a response. Sergeant Ben was just talking. Just talking. And she listened.
"Maybe you should drink more water," Darlene said. "You could be dehydrated or something. The men told me if you mix it with Kool-Aid, it disguises the bad taste."
They were sitting in the oven-hot shade of a tent, and Ruby was so nauseated that she didn't feel she could safely stand.
"When did you last eat?"
Ruby shook her head. Even the thought of food made her ill. The putrid smells were getting to her, the omnipresent rot of the place. She was ready to go home. She missed Javier.
"At least let me ask one of the USO girls for some saltines," Darlene said, already parting the tent flaps.
Ruby lay back on the cot. Flies hovered mere inches from her face, and she swatted uselessly at them. She knew what this was. There was no more fooling herself. She was pregnant. She covered her eyes with her forearm and begged the world to stop spinning. She was back in the dry Vegas heat. Ruby thought she'd treat them both to a steak dinner and tell Javier then. She pictured candlelight, holding hands across a nice linen tablecloth, the weight of quality silverware, an obsequious waiter. They'd celebrate, even though she thought that maybe once she got back to the apartment, she would fall into bed and sleep for weeks. She was so excited to see him again, to touch him. Mostly, she looked forward to seeing his face when she told him. Everything was on track, their dream on the cusp of fulfillment. She'd brought him a souvenir white t-shirt with a drawing of a plane in navy blue ink. In a sardonic take on the United Airlines slogan, it read, "Fly the friendly skies of Vietnam." For herself, she'd bought a skin-tight satin shongsam in deep rose and pink tones, with lilting green leaves and white blossoms. The dress fit Ruby's skin tones perfectly. Maybe she'd wear it to their special dinner, and then likely have to put it away until after the baby was born. She'd have to stop dancing soon enough. But pregnancy was a fitting end to her showgirl career, a perfect start to their San Francisco plan. Ruby waited for over 45 minutes in front of the airport, her suitcase at her feet. She had to pee, but she was afraid of missing Javier when he pulled up to get her. She waited another 15 minutes and at last gave up, picking up her bag and returning to the interior of the airport to use the restroom. Sitting on the toilet, she thought about what a relief it was to be back in modern America, with flush toilets, running water, and essentially clean floors. But as she tore a strip of soft toilet paper from the roll, she worried. Was Javier sick? Had he been hurt? If he was all right, wouldn't he have called the airport? Had her paged to one of the white courtesy phones? Or he'd have asked Vivid or Rose or Dee to come get her. Something was wrong. She pushed down a growing ball of panic, told herself that maybe it was a flat tire. "Don't borrow trouble," she cautioned her reflection in the mirror over the sink. "Everything will be all right." When the cab dropped her off at the Sunglow Apartments, she noticed her Carmen Ghia parked out front. Javier's van, however, was nowhere to be seen. It made sense. If any vehicle broke down, it would be that dilapidated thing. Ruby took the spare key from beneath the mat and pushed open the door. The apartment smelled musty, unused, lonely. She dropped her bag beside the couch and opened the blinds, and then she walked into the bedroom. Javier's camera wasn't on the bureau. There were no dirty clothes on the floor. Ruby opened the closet. His blazer, His spare pair of jeans, his boots, and his Nehru jacket were all gone. So were her furs. She opened the dresser drawer where she kept her boxes of jewelry, the necklaces, rings, bracelets, and earrings of gold, platinum, diamonds, rubies. It was empty. She walked back into the living room, realizing Iago had not yelled, "Oi, Elisa!" when she came through the door. The cage was gone, and so was Javier.
"I haven't seen his van for a couple of days," Vivid said when Ruby knocked on her door. "Come in and have a drink. I'm making G&Ts."
Numbly, Ruby followed Vivid into her kitchen.
"I think he's gone for good this time," she said. "Sure it's not just another one of his fits?"
Vivid squeezed a wedge of lime into each tumbler and handed a glass to Ruby.
"Maybe he's just letting you know you shouldn't have gone off without him."
Vivid walked into the living room and sat on the couch, and Ruby followed. "The parrot's gone."
"Oh, well,"
Vivid hesitated, took a sip of her drink.
"I guess that pretty much says it all, doesn't it?"
Ruby nodded mutely.
"Well, listen, kiddo. I know you don't want to hear this, but maybe it's for the best. I'm pregnant."
"Shit." Ruby took a deep breath and then swallowed half her drink.
"I know someone," Vivid said. "I mean, if you want to take that route."
"I don't know," Ruby shook her head. "I mean, on the flight back, all I was thinking about was cute little baby clothes and cribs and bottles and walking along the wharf in San Francisco, carrying my baby in one of those slings." She squeezed her eyes shut, took another deep breath.
"You can't dance pregnant."
"I know, but I would have a couple months left to earn a little more, save more money, before I start to show."
"And then what?"
"Oh, Vivid, I don't know." Ruby's voice rose with panic. "I don't know about San Francisco without him. I mean..." She stopped as her voice broke, and she fought for control.
"I'm sorry. It's too soon for me to be asking all these questions. Of course you don't know. But as you say, you have a few months to dance, to make up your mind about keeping it. Her, him, shit. It sounds awful, doesn't it?"
"That motherfucker," Ruby said. "Total fuckwad.
You warned me."
"Yeah, well, I wasn't in love with him.
He pretended he was okay with it, with Vietnam. He promised me."
"One more Javier Barrero lie," Vivid said.
"I'm a total fucking idiot."
"Well," Vivid smiled, "you're not a total idiot."
"Fuck me."
"No, fuck him and the boat he came in on," Vivid said, raising her glass for a toast. Ruby sat on the floor of the shower, letting the water run over her as if she could cleanse herself of Javier. He was gone. She tried to think good riddance, but she couldn't quite believe that. She felt crushed, abandoned, lost, stupid, humiliated. She dismissed her friends' opinions as ill-informed, thought they just couldn't see what she saw. He'd thoroughly played her. At least she hadn't ever posed for the nude photos he'd wanted to take. She shook her head, imagining what he would have done with them. But now, what would she do? Who would she be without him? Maybe he'd come back. Maybe, 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 as Janis Joplin sang. He always had. This time, he'd just made it look as though he'd gone for good. That was how angry he'd been, hiding it all beneath a veneer of understanding and good humor. Or maybe he'd truly tried to change, but found himself unable to carry through. After all, the truth was that she'd pushed him too far. She knew how much he needed to be the man, the top dog, and she'd emasculated him by heading across the world to be with thousands of soldiers. She'd left him behind. She'd abandoned him. But if he came back, could she forgive him for the furs, the jewelry? Had he maybe even been pilfering her jewelry all along, hawking it? Was that how he'd paid for San Francisco? At least she'd kept her mother's rings on the chain about her neck, her good luck charm in Vietnam. She held the rings between her fingers now, feeling their reassuring solidity. When the hot water ran out, she stepped out of the shower. Feeling hollowed out, Ruby crawled between the sheets that still smelled of Javier. Much to her amazement, she slept deeply, dreamlessly. The next afternoon, Ruby forced herself to run errands. Her first stop was the bank. She needed to get some cash before picking up groceries. She stood at the cubbyhole desk in the lobby, filled out a withdrawal slip, and waited in line for the next teller. "Hi, Kate." Ruby slid the withdrawal slip across the counter. "Hey, Ruby," Kate said, looking over the slip. "Hold on, all right?" The teller walked over to her supervisor, a man who wore bow ties and wingtips and looked as if he was, and always would be, a fussy bachelor living with his neurotic, widowed mother. He returned to the window with Kate. "Miss Wilde?" he asked. "What is it?" Ruby was only pulling $125. Her savings account held well over $75,000. "You don't have this much in your account," he said, pointing to Ruby's figures on the slip. Ruby laughed. "Of course I do. You know that. Kate?" She looked pleadingly at the teller's familiar face.
"Maybe we should go into my office," he suggested.
"No," Ruby said, standing her ground, despite the sharp drop she felt in her stomach. Had everything gone to hell in the short time she'd been gone?
"Please," she said, "just tell me what's happened to my money."
"Kate, get the file off of my desk, would you?"
Kate scurried off, obviously glad to be out of the line of fire. Ruby drummed her fingertips on the counter while the flustered little man fiddled uselessly with papers, stacking them, making sure the edges were even. When Kate returned, he took the folder and pulled out a document. Pushing it across the counter, he said,
"You'll see this is a notarized statement with your signature."
The document was titled Change of Account Status, and it indicated that Ruby was converting her account to a joint account with Javier Barrero as the second signatory. She could feel the raised impression of the notary's seal, and at the bottom of the page was a nearly perfect rendition of her signature. Ruby looked up into the faces of the two bank employees.
"I did not complete this form."
"It's notarized," the little man said, as if notarization meant God himself had blessed it.
"So what? It's a lie. This document is a lie, a forgery."
"We had no reason to distrust it."
He adjusted his bow tie as if it had suddenly become a garrote.
"Everything was in order."
Kate took a cautionary step back from the counter and then said,
"You came in with him all the time, Ruby. You sent him to cash your casino checks. We saw you here together."
Her voice was plaintive, wheedling.
"He said you were all the way in Vietnam, that you needed for him to cash in your account. We left $50 just to cover any outstanding checks."
"You have to make this right. Someone has to make this right."
Ruby closed her eyes briefly. Someone needed to make her entire life right, to undo all that Javier had done.
"It's out of our hands. We followed bank procedure," the little man said. "You could try filing a federal complaint for theft, but I don't know..."
"You let him take everything," Ruby said, and although she could hear herself talking, she couldn't really feel her feet or her legs.
This wasn't real. It wasn't possible.
"I'm sorry," Kate said.
"Yes," the supervisor added, as Ruby turned and walked away across the lobby. She felt dazed and weak, as if she were stumbling through some awful dream world. This was not happening. She pushed open the glass doors and stepped onto the hot sidewalk, shading her eyes from stark, piercing sunlight. "Lord, I've seen the light," she thought, coming to the street corner. "Now, please let me be," she begged. "No more." Coming home to the empty apartment had dropped her to her knees. This theft of everything she had worked for felled her completely, left her crawling. Were the gods laughing? Was she sufficiently entertaining? She could go no lower. She was scraping her belly along sharp gravel. "I am the stupidest woman alive," she thought, record-breaking stupid. She opened her shoulder bag to find her sunglasses. The 1968 Dodge Dart sedan struck Ruby's legs and tossed her up onto its hood. Her head hit the windshield, sending cracks across the glass like splintering ice. Ruby bounced off of the car and onto the asphalt, where her now unconscious body rolled for another 15 feet, before coming to rest in front of Vernon's old-time ice cream parlor. 20. She swam in a warm soup of morphine. Slow, viscous. She could feel her pain whispering, ready to shout as soon as the drug's power began to wane. Both legs had multiple compound fractures, surgically repaired with metal plates and screws. Her scalp had been split open, and she'd suffered a concussion. Her entire body was tender with bone-deep bruises. She dreamed horrible, drug-laced dreams. Some kind of hell specifically designed for Ruby Wilde. She was the girl in Hans Christian Andersen's The Red Shoes, one of the books the aviator had given her so long ago. In her dream, the red shoes were Dorothy's ruby slippers, but just as in the story, once the shoes were on her feet, they would not come off. They had become part of her, and as long as she wore the shoes, she was forced to dance, nonstop. She danced along the strip, past neon displays and gawking tourists. She skipped up and down curbs, wove through rows of slot machines, and circled roulette tables, tap-danced past Rose at the reception counter in Caesar's. But Rose couldn't catch her. No one could. She danced until her ankles buckled, but still her feet whirled, her legs pranced. Finally, she found the Barrero cabin, hidden away deep in the woods. Soft-shoeing on the front stoop, she pounded on the door, shouting for Javier. He was the only one who could do this. She knew. He was the executioner, the one with the axe. Javier would be strong enough to cut off the shoes, to cut off her feet. Without his blade, she danced herself to death. Whenever she started to swim toward the surface of her dreams, whenever she began to see golden light flickering and thought there might be fresh air within reach, she'd remember. She'd remember what he'd done, what she'd let him do. And she'd remember that she carried his child within her. A child who might be just as felonious, just as coldly devious and heartless as his father. And then she'd stop swimming. She'd stop dreaming. She'd stop trying to reach air. Instead, she'd let her legs go lax, let her arms dangle. She let her body sink once more into the muck of decay, into rest, into oblivion. She felt his presence beside her hospital bed. Ruby turned her head away from him, kept her eyes closed. How could she possibly face him? How could she endure the pressing, boulder-heavy weight of her shame? He took her hand, grasped it firmly, and kissed the back of it. "Lily," he said, simply, softly. She bit her lower lip, squeezed her eyes tightly shut. "I'm here.
the aviator said, squeezing her hand. I know, she squeezed back. I'll take care of you. He took all my money.
I know.
How?
Your friends called me. You had my name in your wallet.
She nodded, still reaching one arm behind her body to keep hold of his hand.
I want to take you home.
Home?
My home, Albuquerque. You'll get better there. Then you can decide what you want to do.
I can't face you, she whispered into her pillow, not sure if he could hear her. With his free hand, the aviator brushed her hair from her temple and kissed her there, where her blood hummed just beneath the thin surface of her skin.
Lily, please look at me. Please.
He waited. She struggled to find just one more ounce of courage, to face her unutterably altered world and the man whose opinion meant the most to her. Slowly, she turned her head and opened her eyes. At 50, he looked tired, careworn, and there were strands of gray threading his short, dark hair. But he was still her handsome, steadfast aviator, and she forced herself to meet his gaze. He smiled crookedly.
I know a lot about mistakes, he said, and yes, some mistakes have dire consequences. But it's not as if you killed someone.
He paused so that she'd remember the depth of his sin.
You trusted someone. You loved someone, and he broke your heart. There's no shame in that.
Always and forever, he was her guardian angel. She pulled his hand to her lips and held it there as she drifted back into a drugged slumber. Ruby could not get over it. The man who flew at supersonic speeds, who regularly broke the sound barrier, was driving a blue station wagon with fake wood side paneling. It was the funniest thing she'd seen in ages. As the hospital personnel transferred her from the gurney to the back of the station wagon, she began giggling.
What?
The aviator asked, smiling with pleasure at her laughter.
A station wagon? Ruby grinned. You?
I'll have you know, he said, helping Jerry, the private nurse he'd hired, to adjust the blankets around Ruby. This is a Chevrolet Kingswood estate wagon.
Oh, an estate wagon. Well then, Ruby smiled.
It has a 350 V8 turbofire engine.
Ha! She laughed.
You wait. Once we get out on the highway, I'll show you what this car can do.
He squeezed one of her big toes where it emerged from thick white plaster. Vivid, Rose, and Dee arrived just then. Vivid stalked to where the aviator stood, her heels putting her at eye level with Ruby's rescuer.
First, we said champagne, she announced. Then Rose, ever the voice of caution and reason, said we couldn't do that, that you couldn't mix painkillers with booze.
To this, Jerry nodded.
Flowers are out because they'll just die, and you got enough of those from all of your admirers, she smiled.
Balloons wouldn't do either, Rose added, bumping around and back with you all the way to New Mexico.
So we did this, Dee shouted, no longer able to bear the long, drawn-out introduction.
She passed a large, wrapped box to Ruby, where she lay propped up on pillows against the rear of the back seat.
Open it!
Ruby tore into the paper and pulled the lid off of the box. Her fingers touched it before she actually saw it, and she stopped, looked out the back end of the car toward her friends.
You didn't, she said.
That rat bastard took all the others, Dee said.
It was a silver fox fur, calf length, nearly identical to the one Kyle had given her.
Oh, Lord.
She sighed with pleasure, feeling the soft fur in her hands. She shook her head.
You know I'm going to say you shouldn't have. This is terribly extravagant.
Of course we should, Rose said.
And Ruby knew that for Rose, the
The cost had been budget-breaking.
This way you won't forget us, Vivid said.
Or Vegas.
As if I could.
Ruby ran her hands along the coat. You know it's the one I most regretted losing.
We know, Vivid said, smiling. Cosmic sex and all.
Ruby glanced quickly at the aviator, but she couldn't tell if he'd heard Vivid.
There is another gift I want, she said, noticing that the lining of this coat was not pink as Kyle's had been, but instead a lovely aqua blue.
Aren't you the greedy little bitch? Dee joked. What else does Her Highness want?
A promise, Ruby said, that you'll come see me.
It's already in the works, Rose assured her. We'll be talking with this lovely man, she said, putting her arm around the aviator's waist and with surprising familiarity, pulling him in until their hips touched. When he says you're ready for a visit, then the three of us will take a road trip.
But I'm only coming if he promises to take me up in one of his planes, Vivid said, flirting.
Ruby saw the aviator's cheeks flush beneath his sunglasses. We're still going to call you Ruby, Dee said. I can't get used to Lily.
I'll answer to just about anything, Ruby said, still stroking the fur coat. I'm gonna miss you like crazy, she assured her friends.
I'm going to check the trailer, the aviator said, diplomatically removing himself for their final goodbyes. He'd rented and packed a U-Haul trailer with what he, along with Vivid and Rose, had decided were Ruby's essential possessions. They'd sold what they could, including her Gia, and Ruby had a thin envelope of bills in her purse. Vivid crawled into the back alongside Ruby, careful not to jostle her.
Did you decide? She asked, and Ruby could smell Vivid's subtle arpège perfume. Not yet, Ruby said as Rose, too, climbed in to be closer to Ruby.
You call if you want to talk, Rose said.
Call no matter what, Vivid said. Does he know? Rose asked, indicating the aviator. Not unless you've told him, Ruby said. Or maybe the doctor said something to him.
Jerry knows, Vivid said, so he probably knows too.
Just get well. Take care of yourself, kiddo. Rose gave Ruby an awkward hug. I love you, she whispered.
Ruby's nose stung with suppressed tears. Vivid kissed her cheek, and then both women crawled back out of the station wagon. Sayonara, sweetheart, Dee said, leaning on the trailer hitch and trying not to cry. Ruby's friends stood there in the Vegas sun as behind them patients and their families flowed endlessly through the hospital's revolving door. The aviator started the car and slowly pulled away from the curb. From her backward perch, Ruby waved farewell.
You all right? Jerry asked. I'm okay, Ruby said, trying to convince herself. But let me know as soon as I can have another pill.
You're hurting?
On so many levels, Ruby said, burying her face in the soft, silver comfort of the coat. Lily Decker. 1. The aviator predicted that they'd be on the road for about 9 hours, including stops and starts. Lily spent a good deal of time staring out the rear window at the U-Haul trailer. With her wheelchair stowed in the back seat, the aviator and Jerry up front like mom and dad, she felt like a child or inanimate cargo. And although she'd imagined that the altered perspective of riding backward would be fun, Lily discovered that it only made her woozy. Fortunately, Jerry fished something out of her medical bag that kept the nausea at bay. Lily hadn't felt she had any choice other than to go with the aviator. Vivid and the others would have tried to take care of her, but it was too much to ask, and they had their own lives. The last thing Lily wanted to be was a burden. She'd had enough of that as a child. But she was also determined to accept the aviator's kindness,
to remember what it felt like to be cared for, truly cared for. And she realized how desperately he wanted to try to whittle away at some of the guilt he felt over her family's destruction. Still, she knew